Thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of the 28 colleges, academies, and seminaries that represent the active and distinctive commitment of the United Church of Christ to higher education in America, along with 18 other schools that honor historical rather than active connections. This group of institutions created by the forebear denominations of the UCC represents a truly extraordinary heritage. Each of these communities of scholars has a compelling story to tell, and many of us on these campuses are wrestling with the question of what it means in our time to be a church-related college, just as we hope all of you will consider carefully what it means for the United Church of Christ to be a college-related church. As you would expect from a college that helped produce giants of the church, such as Reinhold Niebuhr, H. Richard Niebuhr, and Walter Brueggemann, Elmhurst College holds its heritage close to its heart. On this particular day, for example, we celebrate with you the 35th anniversary of the ordination of a contemporary pilgrim, Elmhurst alumnus Bill Johnson. At Elmhurst, support for the spiritual life of our students, for the advance of social justice, and for the creation of inclusive communities is woven into the fabric of the campus. One of the many symbols of this heritage is a special award the college has given only six times. The Niebuhr Medal was created by the college as a way to recognize individuals who have made especially distinguished contributions to humanity in the spirit of Reinhold Niebuhr and H. Richard Niebuhr. In 1999, Elmhurst awarded the Niebuhr Medal to a very special woman. Marion Wright Edelman has for decades been a powerful voice for children, and she has had a profound impact on how many people think about public policy and private commitments. Through the Children's Defense Fund and in many other settings, she speaks from the heart about the most important people in the world, our children. And she insists that we think of them all as, in fact, our children. To express the gratitude of Elmhurst College to the church, which has meant so much to us for 50 years, and on behalf of all of the UCC institutions of higher learning, we decided that we wanted to bring to this historic gathering the gift of Marion Wright Edelman. In her warm and personal book, Lanterns, A Memoir of Mentors, Mrs. Edelman writes of the women and men who directly influenced what she became and whose lives still speak to her. Their examples, she writes, make me stand up when I want to sit down, try one more time when I want to stop, and go out the door when I want to stay home and relax. It is an honor for Elmhurst College to present to this anniversary General Synod someone whose example makes us all stand up when we want to sit down, Marion Wright Edelman.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. I can't tell you how grateful and honored I am to be here on your 50th anniversary with President Curran, with John Thomas, with your wonderful leadership team, and with all of you to share what we've got to do together to build a movement to reset America's moral compass and to make our faith a reality. We are living in a time of unbearable dissonance between promise and performance, between good politics and good policy, between professed and practiced family values, between racial creed and racial deed, between calls for community and rampant individualism and greed, and between our capacity to prevent and alleviate human deprivation and disease, and our political and spiritual will to do so. Something is awry when the net worth of the world's 942 richest people, all billionaires, exceeds the combined income of 1.6 billion people who live in 66 countries with the lowest gross domestic product, and when the income gap between the top and bottom 20% of the world's population has risen from 30-fold to over 70-fold in the last generation. Something is awry in the United States when over 1.7 million families lived on less income than was received in 1 year by one private equity firm executive. And when our three richest Americans have wealth or income equivalent to 50 million American citizens living in 25 states, and they did not need a tax cut in 2001, they did not need another tax cut in 2003 and 2004. And at a time when 47 million Americans need health insurance, they don't need those tax cuts extended. It's time to get our heads back on straight. As people of faith, we're living at an incredibly moral and perilous moment in history. Few human beings are blessed to experience the beginning of a new century and millennium. How will we say thanks for the life and earth and nations and children God has entrusted to our care? What legacies, principles, values, and deeds will we stand for and send to the future through our children to their children? And to a spiritually confused, balkanized, and violent world that is desperately hungering for moral leadership and community. How are we going to measure progress over the next 1,000 years, or 100 years if we survive them? By the kill power and number of weapons of destruction we can produce and traffic at home and abroad, or by our willingness to shrink, indeed destroy, the prison of violence constructed in the name of peace and security? Will we be remembered at the beginning of the 21st century by how many material things we can manufacture, advertise, sell, and consume, or by our rediscovery of more lasting, non-material measures of success? A new Dow Jones for the purpose and quality of life in our families and neighborhoods and cities and congregations and national and world communities. Will we be remembered by how rapidly technology and corporate merger mania and greed can render human beings obsolete, or for a better balance that we insist on as citizens and people of faith between corporate profits and corporate caring for children and families and communities and the environment? Will we be remembered as people of faith and as Americans by how much a few at the top can get at the expense of the many at the bottom and in the middle, or by our struggle for a concept of enough for all? The answers lie in the values that you and I stand for, and how we live out our faith, and how we stand up for justice for all within our world community and national community. What an opportunity for good or evil we personally and collectively hold in our hands as parents and citizens, as faith leaders, as educators, and how much responsibility do we have to hold accountable the political leaders that we elect? Let's get out there and let us hear a real vote for justice on the next go round. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, whom I quote all the time, the great Protestant theologian who was executed for opposing Hitler's Holocaust, believed that the test of the morality of a society is how it treats its children. Well, the United States flunks Bonhoeffer's test every day of the year. We sit and we let a child be abused or neglected every 36 seconds. We could fill up the city of Detroit each year with the 906,000 children who are abused or neglected. A child dies from abuse every 6 hours. A child is born into poverty every 36 seconds as well. Why are there 13 million poor children in the richest nation on earth in 2007? We have got to change that and end child poverty and family poverty in America. We lead the world in per capita health expenditures, yet we permit a baby to be born without health insurance every 47 seconds. 90% of the 9 million uninsured children live in working families. And I'm going to come back and talk about that, because this is the year when the CHIP program, or the State Children's Health Insurance Program, comes up for renewal, that we have an opportunity and a responsibility to cover every single child. God did not say, bring some of them to me, or half of them to me. And in this country, we need to say this is the year and hold our leaders accountable for every child getting health care. We have all been shocked by the massacre at Virginia Tech. But a child is killed by a firearm almost every 3 hours, almost 8 a day. We have a Virginia Tech chronically, quietly, relentlessly, every 4 days in the United States of America. Since 1979, we began to keep gun violence and statistics by children, we have lost over 100,000 children to gunfire, and three times as many as that have been injured. That's more than twice the number of American battle casualties in the Vietnam War. What is it going to take to get people of faith to say we're going to stand up and stop the killing of children by guns? Now, these statistics reflect children in every race, place, and family type. But minority children fare far worse. Black babies are 4 times as likely as white babies to see their mothers die in childbirth, are more than twice as likely to be of low birth weight and to die before their first birthday. Black children are 3 times as likely as white children and more than 4 times to be poor, and 4 times as likely to live in extreme poverty, and child poverty has been increasing in recent years. Nearly 1 in 3 Latino and Black children is poor. And children and families with annual incomes less than $15,000 are 22 times more likely to be abused or neglected than those with annual incomes of $30,000 or more. Almost 1 in 4 of our Black and Latino 2-year-olds are not fully immunized, even though every dollar we invest in immunizing children for preventable diseases saves $16 in emergency care. Never could figure out why it's so hard to get America to do what's right for its children and to save money. And I don't know what we're going to do to get us to come and do the smart thing as well as the right thing. Too many children in our foster care system are disproportionately Black. And we've got to begin to deal with the racial disparities in all of our child caring systems. And children who age out of foster care are less likely to graduate from high school or college, to experience serious mental health problems, including post-traumatic stress disorders in the general public, are less likely to have adequate health and mental health care, and to experience homelessness. But the figure that worries me most, and which is what I want you to remember today, is what I call the beginning of the cradle to prison pipeline, because a Black preschool boy born in 2001 has a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison in his lifetime. A black preschool girl has a 1 in 17 chance, and while we need to focus on black males, black girls cannot be forgotten. And we've got to deal with the fact that we're criminalizing our children at earlier and earlier ages. Indeed, we're sending preschool children and 6- and 7-year-old children out of school for offenses that used to be handled on the school grounds in handcuffs at the feet and at the ankles. I think we've lost our minds as adults. But if you think of the implications of 1 in 3 black boys going off to prison, and what that means in terms of the disempowerment of the black community, the disempowerment of the black family, children losing fathers, but they come out of prison, they can't find a job because they've got a prison record, they can't vote in many states, and you're talking about a return to the past, and we have got to name the cradle to prison pipeline. And we've got to change the cradle to prison pipeline because it is going to lose all of the hard-earned racial and social progress. Education has a lot of to do with it. Nearly 70% of blacks in prison never completed high school. A Harvard Civil Rights Project and Urban Institute reports says that only 13% of black, 15% of Latino, and 41% of white fourth graders are reading at grade level. And this number stays low, only 7% of black, 12% of Latino, and 37% of white eighth graders perform at grade level in math. Now, if a child can't read in this globalizing economy, you are sentencing that child to social and economic death. I don't know how it can be possible for a country that has figured out how to mine millions, billions, trillions of dollars from a tiny microchip, has broken the genetic code, has sent spaceships to Mars and humans to the moon, and we can't make the political and spiritual commitment to teach our children to read. Where is the voice of people of faith? The cumulative, because children don't come in pieces, the cumulative and convergent impact of a child beginning life with fragile, single, young, unprepared, and poor parents, usually a mother who often lacks early prenatal and postpartum care to detect physical, emotional, or substance abuse problems, at low birth weight, spending the early years in stressed families, living in shelters and houses, an unsafe community, without strong family supports and kinship networks, and with community child service systems and public systems lacking. There's a study from Kansas City that says by age 3, by researchers Hart and Riesley, that by age 3, there's already a 30 million word interaction gap between children of affluent parents and children of welfare mothers. You can't teach what you don't know, yet early Head Start reaches only 3% of the eligible children. But by age 3, and then Head Start and lack of quality child care and the lack of a universal preschool system means that we've got many of these children going through their early years without the stimulation and help that every child needs. Then they go to schools that are the least well-funded, the least well-prepared, the least prepared teachers, the least good laboratories and libraries, and the cycle goes on. They get frustrated in school, they act out in school, their health problems are undetected, they can't see the blackboard sometimes or hear the teacher, then they get suspended or expelled, and now they get arrested, and the lack of comprehensive health and mental health care, failing schools that don't expect children to learn, and I tell everybody that teaching is probably, after parenting, the most important profession that we have. And if you don't love children, don't go into teaching. Because I don't care how good the classroom is or how fancy the school. If children feel you don't respect them and love them and expect them to learn, and all of us who are dealing with children every day must understand how we transmit to those children, how they value, how we value them, and how they value themselves. And too many of our folk who deal with children every day don't expect or help poor and minority children to learn. Then we combine this with zero tolerance, discipline policies that used to be handled in community, the absence of role models and positive alternatives to the streets. We need to open up these church doors and have children come someplace that's safe after school and in the summer so that they can be with caring adults when parents are working. And all this adds up to just a staggeringly unlevel playing field, which contributes to so many children who are poor and minority being sucked into a cradle to prison to death pipeline, that we have got to speak out and come together and dismantle. Let me just give you one child that Judge Clark out in Seattle, the Kings County, the chief judge, shared. His name was a little boy. She talked about Danny. He said, "I watched the flow of children through my courtroom, but it took me time to actually understand the interplay or complicity, if you will, of two primary feeders into the pipeline, the juvenile justice system and child welfare system. And a young black man who is arrested for a drug offense is 48 times more likely to go to jail for that drug offense, and a young Latino man who has a comparable drug offense with a young white man is likely 9 times more likely to be detained or incarcerated." And so we've got to deal with these disparities that still come throughout all of our systems. But at any rate, she talks about the juvenile justice and the child welfare system. And excuse me, his name was Frankie. And she said, "Let me tell you about Frankie, who first came to me at age 10, and he's now presumed to have the capacity to commit a crime. He was charged with assault 4, a misdemeanor. Frankie was born into the child welfare system, removed from his mother at birth. He spent his first 8 years moving from foster home to foster home, getting angrier and more depressed. His angry outburst landed him in a therapeutic foster home placement for kids with behavioral problems. Of course, once he was placed, he continued to demonstrate his behavioral issues. He hit the staff, the police were called, he's arrested, charges are filed. It's clear that the therapeutic foster home is using the courts to enforce the rules and provide much-needed respite care. But this created a criminal record for Frankie, and over the next 5 years, this pattern repeats itself several times. I last saw Frankie 6 months ago when he presented on 2 counts of robbery, 2 felony charges. His lengthy criminal history created from his behavior and placement counts to increase his score for the purposes of sentencing. Frankie was facing 206 to 258 weeks in juvenile state prison. By the time he's released, Frankie will be almost 18, and he has literally been moved through the pipeline from the cradle. Next stop, the adult prison system. The only universal child policy in our nation, the only thing we will guarantee to every child, is a jail or a detention cell after they get into trouble. States spend almost 3 times more on average per prisoner than per public school pupil. You and I have to build a movement to change those investment priorities, because that's just plain wrong. These facts are not acts of God. They are our moral, political, and economic choices, and people of faith, we all must stand up and say we're going to change them. We're going to hold a national summit in September 25th, 26th at Howard University on the Cradle to Prison Pipeline, and we're going to spend 80% of our time on the solutions. These children just need what our children need, and they've got to be our children. But we've got to come and name this lest we go backwards and ignore the sacrifice of so many. But we've got to begin to change the values and priorities in our families and communities. We've got to reweave the fabric of family and community. And when people often ask me what's wrong with our children, I say what's wrong with our children is adults. Our children do what we do, and they desperately need us to stand up and speak to them. And I hope that every adult will regularly take a personal audit, because James Baldwin said correctly a long time ago that our children very seldom do what we tell them to do, but they almost always do what we do. So if we're using and abusing drugs, why are we surprised that our children are? If we're lying and stealing and not giving our time and money to take care of our children and to help build community, our children will do the same. If we tell or snicker at racial jokes or any stereotypes that are intended to demean another human being, then our children are going to pass on that poison. And I want to just amen the need for us all to stand up against the growing racial and gender and ethnic and religious intolerance in our land. Don't let anybody in your presence speak ill of others on the basis of something they can't decide. And we all know, as people of faith, what still is the most segregated hour in American society. And we need to renew our commitment to diversity and to all of God's children, for all of them are God's children. I want to just end by asking us to just do one thing for children this year, and that is to get health care. I cannot bear the fact that there are children who are dying and suffering every day because this country, unlike every other industrialized nation, does not provide them with the basic health care. We've drafted the All Healthy Children's Act, but as the CHIP program is being debated this week and this month, and in September it expires, this is the chance to say we want all children covered, all of them. God didn't say some. All, that we want them all to have comprehensive, guaranteed benefits for mental health and dental health. It's a moral scandal that those Katrina children are still out there waiting for us to provide them mental health care. And we want to make it easy, not hard, for children to get health care. And so we really want any child health bill, CHIP bill, to make it automatic that children are enrolled at birth, when they start school, if they are in a school lunch or any means-tested program. And all of these provisions are included in the All Healthy Children's Act, 1488 in the House, 1564 in the Senate, but the CHIP bill must contain these kinds of provisions. And I want to tell you that your leaders are telling us that we can't afford this year to cover all of our children. To give all children health insurance, and we would do it up to 300% of the federal poverty level with the right of others to buy in above that, would cost about $70 billion. They're now talking $50 billion, but they say, well, that will leave about 4 or 5 million children behind, but that's all that we politically can see our way to do. And I tell you, we're going to have a hard time unless you stand up even getting that $50 billion. But I don't think it's right to leave 5 million children behind, because what's going to happen to those children? I want to tell you about three of them, and you're going to see some of their families at the end of my presentation. Little Diamante Driver, and we've been trying to get a sense of urgency. I want to be very clear. The Children's Defense Fund wants health coverage for every single person in America. But children can't wait until we go through another 3 or 4 years of consensus, and what children get this year is going to determine what they get. But Little Diamante Driver was 12 years old. His mother tried to get him a dentist, went to 26 dentists who wouldn't take Medicaid and CHIP children, couldn't get it. The tooth abscessed, it infected his brains. The tooth extraction cost about $80. He spent 7 weeks in a children's hospital at taxpayer cost of $250,000, but it was too late to save his life. He died. He was 12. A few weeks later, little 6-year-old Alex Callender down in Pass Christian, Mississippi, had two teeth that abscessed. Couldn't find a dentist. One dentist down on the Gulf Coast would take Medicaid children, not adequate service. Mother took him off to emergency room when the child's teeth got infected, even though he had been pulled. Wrong antibiotics. She took him off of them. Got another set of antibiotics prescribed. He took them all, but 3 days after he finished, he died on his school bus going to school. And the same day, a third child, Devante Johnson, whose mother did everything right, as did these other two mothers, but she knew her son had kidney cancer, and she tried 2 months before his Medicaid in Texas was to expire to get it renewed because she knew he needed his chemotherapy and radiation. And he got the paperwork kept getting lost. 5 to 6 million of the 9 million uninsured children are eligible either for Medicaid or CHIP. That's why we're trying to put them together so that these big cracks will no longer be there and children will not fall through and not get what they need. But the bottom line is that he went for 4 months without his radiation, and he died the same day that Alex Callender died. That's not acceptable. Children should not be dying from preventable things or from tooth abscesses in the United States of America. And you and I shouldn't let any political leader of any party stand up and say we can't do better than this. They say we got to find a way to pay for it. I'm so glad they've learned how to be fiscally responsible, but you know, we didn't pay when we went to Iraq. We did not pay when we did those tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, and they should not be asking suffering children to pay for their health care. They can find the money if they want to do it and if we make them do it. So I really hope that you will stand up and insist that the least this country can do for the least powerful among us is to say that we're going to give them a healthy start, that they are born healthy, and that they will get a chance to go to school and see and hear and be able to learn. And so I just beg you, as you hear and see the stories, and I appreciate so much that your witness and justice minister, Reverend Jaramillo, came with faith leaders to Washington, with mothers and fathers of suffering and dying children, to say, let's cover our children. But I'll tell you, it's not gonna happen. All will not get a fair chance unless you speak up and provide a strong, unwavering witness. And I hope you will. I hope you'll go to our booth. I hope you'll sign those cards. I hope you'll call. I hope you will dog them back home. And I hope everywhere they go, they say, are you going to cover all of our children this year? And I hope that every presidential candidate and everybody running for office, Republican and Democrat alike, because our children are not partisan political fodder. Their health should be something that we guarantee, but they won't help unless you insist. Let me end with a prayer to ask God to forgive and help us work together and stand up to transform our rich nation, where small babies and children suffer and die from preventable diseases and sickness quite legally. God, forgive and transform our rich nation, where small children suffer from hunger quite legally. Forgive and transform our rich nation, where toddlers and school children die from guns so quite legally. God, forgive us and help us to transform our rich nation that lets the rich continue to get more at the expense of the poor quite legally. Forgive and transform our rich nation that thinks security rests in missiles and bombs rather than in mothers and in babies. Forgive and transform our rich nation for not giving you sufficient thanks by giving to others their daily bread. Help us as people of faith never to confuse what is quite legal with what is just and right in your sight. Help us in this meeting, this great gathering, and when we go back home as leaders and people of faith, to speak up and stand up for all of your children and give them the anchor of faith, the rudder of hope, the sails of health care and education, and the paddles of family and community to navigate the tumultuous sea of life and land safely on the shores of adulthood. Amen.
Devontae was diagnosed with cancer at 10 years old. During the process of taking chemo, we lost insurance. And by the time they tried to do anything, it was just too late for him. The cancer had gotten too bad. What could I do but to continue to fight? I wanted my child to live.
I couldn't find a job that would give me health coverage. You tell me, how can I look into my daughter's eyes and tell her, you cannot live because your mother doesn't have enough money to buy medication for you?
Twelve-year-old Diamante Driver died from an infection in his brain caused by bacteria from an infected tooth. His mother contacted over 26 dentists seeking help for her child. All refused. The dentists would not accept children on Medicaid. When Diamante was finally diagnosed with a brain infection, he endured two brain surgeries. His hospital costs were over $250,000. The cost to extract his tooth? $80,000. He died on February 25th, 2007.
Six years ago, I was involved in a car wreck and broke my back. And if they can't have medical insurance for simple medical things, like shots, what are we teaching them? We're teaching them that our children aren't important.
Father of four children. I'm scared.
We're all asking for help, and we need help.
Before I left New Orleans due to Hurricane Katrina, we had Medicaid.
Really understand why we don't have it, but she said she was trying her best to try to get insurance for us.
It's been a problem for a whole year. I don't understand it. Just praying and trusting God that my son don't get sick.
These will begin showing, but again, we can stop this, and so I hope you will raise your voice. Thank you, and God bless you.
Miss Marion, sometimes we feel such deep despair. Seems like nobody cares, and we don't know where to turn. So inadequate, don't know how to change it. Know what to do now, how to make those fires burn. Feel so powerless, the forces of evil seem so large. We feel so small just now, and we don't know. Promise that we make, even though we're frightened, this is where we'll go. We will stand up when we want to sit down. We'll keep speaking out. We simply want to stop. We'll walk out the door when we want to go home or run away. and we won't sit down until the job is done. Oh, Frankie, maybe it's too late for you. Maybe we let you down, 'cause we're so afraid to speak. Oh, Diamante, we hold you in our minds. Somehow we left you behind, 'cause we felt so churches. All the words we say seem to fall on such deaf ears, and we're scared to move. We don't know what we need to do next. This is our promise. We're standing here, and we will stand up when we want to sit down. We'll keep speaking out when we want to stop, and we will walk out the door when we want to stay home or run away. And we won't sit down until the job is done. Oh, Miss Marion, for all these years you've led the way, mentor and guide each day. For that, our thanks to you. But it's time for us to get our shoes on and follow you in all the hard places you must go till the job is through. We will stand up when we want to sit down. We will speak out when we just want to stop. We will walk out the door when we want to stay home or run away. And we will not sit down until this job is done.
Good to be with you again.
Thank you. The stand up for Devante and Diamante. Thank you.